Daniel, thank you very much. I also very much appreciate the note of optimism. Running an NGO for 30 years, you have to be optimistic, and you were. Thank you. Nasir, I invite you to the podium.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, John, for having organized this conference, which I am delighted to be part of. The topic that I'm going to address this morning is politicide and the impediments to a peaceful solution. I will argue that the diplomatic paralysis and the crippling impasse in the Middle East are embedded in the so-called peace process itself. As long as ending the Israeli occupation is not on the active agenda, the longest occupation in history will continue unabated. Moreover, peace will not be at hand as long as 1948 Nakba is not recognized for what it is, a form of ethnic cleansing, a colonial enterprise which covets the land without the people. Peace will also remain elusive as long as the 1967 occupation remains entrenched as a form of politicide. Politicide, genocide, and as long as U.S. diplomacy is associated with both calamities. The late Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling, who authored a book with the title Politicide, defined it as a process, and I quote, that has as its ultimate goal the dissolution of the Palestinian people's existence as a legitimate national, social, or economic entity, which may also include partial or total ethnic cleansing. This is the definition by Kimmerling. Politicide rather than occupation is a process that covers a wide range of social, political, military, and bureaucratic activities whose goal is to destroy the political and national existence of a whole community of people and thus deny it the possibility of self-determination. This is what Israel has been doing since 1948, destroying the very fabric of the Palestinian nation. It has intensified the destruction in 1967, and the process is ongoing. The national aspirations of the Palestinians for full independence have thus been thwarted, not only by military means, but also by diplomatic, bureaucratic, and demographic policies, all of which are components of this politicide. The real function of the peace process, therefore, has been to shelter Israel from the threat of peace, to enable Israel to escape its obligations to the Palestinian people under international law. These obligations have been effectively replaced by Israeli decrees presented as American peace initiatives. Not only has the U.S. succeeded in regularizing the 1967 occupation, but it has also engaged in diplomatic outsourcing, thus consigning part of the diplomatic facade to the quartet. Indeed, since the inception of this so-called peace process, Washington has been acting as peacemaker, while at the same time it served as Israel's chief weapon supplier, bankroller, and diplomatic backer. How did it manage to promote the Israeli agenda without being held to account? Most importantly, at present, how did the so-called negotiations become Mahmoud Abbas's sole strategic option, that's how he described it, when these negotiations have never produced any progress, not at Camp David, not at Oslo, not at Sharm el-Sheikh, not at Annapolis, and not in Jerusalem recently. During the past few decades, Israel and the U.S. have pursued policies which dealt a crippling blow to the two-state solution, which could have created an independent Palestinian state and terminated the Israeli occupation. This derailment was accomplished through futile but focused diplomatic efforts invested by presidents from Nixon to Bush II. 41 years have elapsed since the 1967 occupation, 15 years since Oslo, 8 years since the Mitchell Report, 8 years after Taba, 7 years since the Zinni mission, 5 years after the roadmap, 6 years since the Saudi plan, and 1 year since Annapolis. After all this, peace has remained hopelessly elusive. But nevertheless focused, with the U.S. continuing to pretend that it is the chief, if not sometimes the sole peacemaker. Neither did earlier attempts to reactivate the peace process fare any better. So since 1948, the question of Palestine has been the focus of numerous UN resolutions that uphold the right of Palestinians to return to their land and property, to establish their own independent state alongside Israel, to receive compensation, and to gain restitution. Indeed, a global consensus had prevailed throughout the 1970s and the 1980s in support of a diplomatic settlement based on the international legal framework. But all efforts towards an equitable settlement were sabotaged, ironically, by none other than the managers of the peace process itself. A legacy of rejectionism on the part of Israel and the self-designated peacemaker has prevailed ever since the Rogers Plan of 1969. Israel has managed to reject a number of U.S. proposals, even when some of these proposals did not include full withdrawal from occupied territories and/or Palestinian sovereignty. The first casualty was the Rogers Plan, followed by Israel's frustration of Governor Scranton's mission on behalf of President Nixon in 1970, also the rejection of President Sadat's Land for Peace and Mutual Recognition proposal of 1971, the rejection of President Carter's call for a Geneva International Conference in 1977, the Reagan Plan of 1982, the Schultz Plan of 1988, the Baker Points, because he did not want it to be called a plan, of 1989, and the successful efforts to thwart President Bush's senior's attempt to link loan guarantees to the issue of Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem in 1990. Obviously, President Bush, the son, is keenly aware of his father's ordeal as he embarked on integrating his strategy into that of General Ariel Sharon. The PLO and the Arab states had associated themselves with this global consensus that I've been talking about, and expressed in countless documents, including the 1971 Sadat offer, the Security Council resolution of 1976 calling for implementation of Resolution 242, and a two-state solution, the European Venice Declaration in June of 1980 on behalf of the European Community, which used to be called European Council at that time, that recognized the Palestinian right to self-determination. So it's really a global consensus that I'm talking about here. Add to it the 1981 Fahd Plan, which is a Saudi plan, and then there is, of course, the 1988 PLO recognition of Israel, the 1998 European Union Declaration, all the way up to the new Saudi plan adopted by the Arab League in Beirut in March of 2002, offering full recognition of Israel in exchange for ending the occupation. The theory and practice of the peace process, which was based on the assumption that peace in the Middle East can only emanate from Washington, had in effect undermined all serious efforts to bring peace to the region. The history of U.S. foreign policy in the region during the past four decades reveals that every single administration since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza had a Middle East plan named after a U.S. president and or a Secretary of State. That same history reveals that, with the exception of Baker, who did not want it to be a plan, that same history reveals that each of these plans negated true Palestinian self-determination, raising the question of whether these plans had ever been meant for implementation. The common denominator of all these U.S. plans was the non-recognition of the original injustice done to the Palestinians in 1948, by the way. Not one of them had acknowledged the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination or the unambiguous need to terminate the 1967 Israeli occupation or provide restitution to the Palestinian victims. The Palestinians thus were denied all forms of international protection. The U.S. has used its Security Council veto nearly 50 times, either to shelter Israel from international reproach for violating the human and national rights of the Palestinian people, or to deny the Palestinians international protection from an ongoing Israeli campaign of ethnic cleansing, dispossession, and Bantustanization of the occupied territories. Thus, Israel has been able to escape public and diplomatic scrutiny. The U.S.-led campaign against multilateralism has been pursued so vociferously and actively that any mention of international law, the right of return for refugees, and even UN resolutions has become to the U.S., to Israel, and to some European allies the equivalent of intransigence and anti-peace obstruction. Why has peace been such a threat to Israeli leaders? And I will conclude with this, just one page of conclusion. For Israel, the danger of a permanent peace emanates from a perceived demographic threat. Sometimes between 2005-2010, Palestinian Arabs living under U.S. control were to become a majority between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea for the first time since 1948. At present, the number of Palestinians living between the river and the sea under Israeli control is approximately 5.2 million, compared to 5.1 million Israelis. Short of giving the Palestinians equal rights in one state, Israel is left with three options. Option number one is to acquiesce in the establishment of a separate sovereign Palestinian state. The second option is to expel much of the Palestinian population. And the third option is keeping the Palestinians confined in apartheid-style cantons, which in essence is Sharon's plan of 1981. America's pretense for the role of honest broker is finished, I think. It was conclusively finished when the U.S., Israel, and the PA could not accept Hamas's electoral victory. The U.S., Abbas, and Israel are determined to undo that victory, first by the embargo and attempts at starvation, and now by abducting the top Hamas leadership and smashing its infrastructure. Abbas, Olmert, and Bush have colluded to bar Hamas from assuming actual power, thus causing a bloody war among certain sub-factions of Fatah and Hamas. Despite the formation of a government of national unity in the Mecca Agreement, neither the U.S. nor Israel is now willing to revive a peace process and pursue negotiations in good faith. Thus, diplomatic failure has been embedded, as I began with, I conclude with, in the peace process, and that whole strategy contributed to the beginning of a new discourse about a single state based on the equal protection of the law. In conclusion, what the new president should do, I think he should convene a working group of respected individuals known for their wide familiarity with the situation and for their integrity, this panel should study the numerous plans that I mentioned in my talk here over the past four decades and determine why they did not succeed after 40 years. Thank you very much.